Donald in the kitchen talks about food. Donald in the kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
To talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. Center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Welcome to our table today. We're going to be talking about the African-American traditions of food. This is kind of the end of Black History Month, and we had a really good experience about going to a good lecture the other evening, and we met a really good cookbook author and historian named Jessica Harris.
Yes, Jessica B. Harris gave a lecture last night, and we thoroughly enjoyed it. She is actually a New York City resident, but she has for many years been one of the sort of authorities on the culinary traditions of Native Americans and you know, the history of what the slaves brought with them and how the whole shebang. And her book is called High on the Hog, at least her most famous book, which has become a Netflix series, which is released a few years ago, and apparently is going to go into a second season. Now, she is not in the Netflix series, but the Netflix series is based on her work, and, she's basically a historian, a culinary historian. Lovely, lovely woman. We thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm going to read a little bit from her book. So this phrase, high in the hog, we've heard that for a long time. It certainly resonates here in Iowa, where we're the one of the, well, we got a lot of hogs around here anyway. So so here's from, right from High on the Hog. It says, old master killed about 40 or 50 hogs every year. He had John to help him. And when he was ready to pay him off, he said, John, here's your pig head, your pig feet, and pig's ears. And John said, thank you, boss. So John killed hogs for about 5 years that way. And that's what he got for his pay. You know, the parts that the master didn't really want to eat, right? Then John moved back to on the back of the place and got himself 3 hogs. Old master didn't even know he had a hog. Next winter at hog killing time, old master went down after John. Old master says, John. John comes to the door. Yes, sir. Old master says, be down to the house early in the morning. I want to kill hogs. Be there about 5:30. John asks, well, old master, what are you paying? I'll pay you like I always did. I'll give you the head and all the ears and all the pig's feet and all the tails. And John said, well, old master, I can't because I'm eating higher on the hog than that now. I got 3 pigs of my own, and I eat spare ribs, backbone, pork chops, Midlands ham, and everything else. I eat high on the hog now.
Well put. Well put. Because certain cuts are more desirable, I guess, although you can get good food off of almost anything, as I recall. We have to think often, I believe, about the gifts that were brought by immigrants and the slaves, who were not exactly immigrants in this.
They were not willing immigrants.
But they brought their knowledge with them, and much of what they brought is still with us today. And we have to remember that way back when, before, well, you know, the 1500s and so, this country had certain vegetables and foodstuffs, and the European countries had certain vegetables, and the African countries had certain things to eat. And we really didn't share a lot then. The commerce over the Atlantic Ocean wasn't really
no, because the world was flat.
The world was flat. Europeans hadn't discovered things like tomatoes
and corn we sent
turkeys
over there, yeah.
Yeah, and peppers, and we really didn't, and the folks here in the New World, There was stuff that we got from Africa, too, and from Europe. And
well, like Dr. Harris was saying last night, try to imagine Italian cuisine before tomatoes.
Right.
And try to imagine German cuisine before potatoes.
See? That things will have been stirred up, and so we eat, well, we don't not only eat high on the hog now, we eat high on the planet. We are kind of aware of things all around the planet now, but people used to have to make do with what grew close to where they grew up. There was and when you think about African-American influences on our food, we always have to remember that there is this, well, we are, and rightly so, we still are uncomfortable with this idea of slavery. There is a, talk about the little video, Donna, that is available.
Oh, yeah, there was something Jessica Harris suggested we all look at. It's the two-minute history of the Atlantic slave trade. And all it is a timeline going from about 14-something or other through, you know, several hundred years with little dots of all of the slave ships. And it shows the increase in frequency and where the trade routes were. And surprisingly enough, most of the slave trading that ended up in North America landed in the Caribbean. It looks like a lot more went into South America. Of course, that big bulge where Brazil is a lot closer to Africa, so it would have been a shorter boat trip, arduous though it must have been, unbelievably. But it does give you an idea of the, over the first several hundred years, how much more traffic there was.
Just kind of thinking, every one of those little dots, it's actually quite well done. You watch all those little ships, little dots go across, and it gets pretty dark there in the ocean, long about the middle of the 1700s and the 1800s. 1800s, pretty much, yes. And I have to remember that all those little dots were not just a couple of folk coming across. This was commerce. This was people
right,
making
they had to
big
have a,
money.
A boatload to make it worth
big
the,
money.
The
big
trip.
Money in selling human beings, and those human beings brought with them their traditions, and they were the people, especially in well-to-do households. It was usually often the slaves that did the cooking and actually raise the crops. So we owe them a whole lot. There's a lot of things that we can learn from the traditions of black cooks. And one thing I kind of have, in my reading and in discussions and things that I've been kind of thinking about, yes, there was all of the slaves that were on plantations and in servitude to white people, because at that time you could own people. But there's also a huge history of the slaves that bought their own freedom, were born free, freeborn slaves, and later people that moved from the South into the into the North. And actually, because there was a food growing and a food preparing history, many, many of the black people were entrepreneurs that baked, they cooked, they served, they were really involved in the food history and the food preparation in the United States, and it mixed with everything else. It wasn't just always in a southern plantation. It was, they moved to California, they moved to Chicago, they moved to, and also some of them had all kinds of other traditions. So not only traditions they brought with them, but cooking for many people that expected things like high French cooking and all that sort of thing too. So there's so when you think about black cooks, there is a huge, wonderful tradition and lots to learn, lots to explore.
Well, sort of my takeaway from watching both the Netflix series and reading some of Jessica Harris's work, what they're saying is, you know, the influence of the black people on the foods in this country is not limited to what we think of as, you know, barbecue and collard greens and things like that. And I think this is true, you know, from my many years of experience. Food service is often, it is a very entrepreneurial business, and the entry skill set is pretty specific. I mean, everybody eats. A lot of people know how to cook. Even in my experience, because I did not start by going to some fancy culinary school. I started by working in restaurants. And it is still a place, and still to this day, where you can start at the bottom as the dishwasher or the server or whatever, and as your skill set increases, you can learn and move yourself up if you're so inclined. And so I think that probably, you know, contributed to a lot of the accessibility. But what she's saying in the book is that this country is profoundly influenced by the black culture of food making. And you can see that everywhere. It's even, you know, even when you come to Iowa, which is, you know, we don't have a large black population, but we do have a lot of, we still eat a lot of pork and a lot of corn. Those are American food staples. Although the corn we grow here is not the corn that we eat. That's a whole different story. But she was talking about, and I think this was in the Netflix video, when you see like that Aunt Jemima pancake box, to use that image of Aunt Jemima to sell the product, it was a connotation of superior quality. You know, that these black cooks knew what they were doing, and it was a good marketing advertisement because of the quality of the black contributions to our culinary history. So something really, I really enjoyed the Netflix series, and the book is fascinating. And there's another book, Lana. Tell us about the other.
Oh, yes.
A recipe book, more or less. Yeah. High on the Hog has a few recipes, but is a history book, basically, not a recipe book.
I received it as a Christmas gift, I believe, a couple years ago, a book called Jubilee, Recipes from 2 Centuries of African-American Cooking by the author Tony Tipton Martin. And actually, the recipes are lovely, and according to me, a good quality recipe book has good pictures. It has lovely pictures, and I've cooked some of the recipes. But it wasn't until I went to this lecture, or knew this lecture was coming up, that I actually went back and read all the introductory information and all the sidebars and all the history she includes here. Actually, the author, Tony Tipton Martin, quotes Jessica B. Harris every now and then, because she's a really good food historian, talking about the importance of good food and the African-American history. I want to read a little bit about biscuits. Biscuits, the idea of bread, staff of life. White flour biscuits were once considered a delicacy, a Sunday treat, something special on Christmas morning, made with what the enslaved people called seconds or shorts, meant the coarsest leavings from processing wheat into white flour, a little pig fat, and this crude fare still reveals the delight African captives took in the simple pleasures like hot bread for breakfast. The story was different if you were a free person of color operating a baking business, and this was not all that unusual. Access to white flour and new technologies such as baking powder made it possible to produce biscuits of fine quality. In 1866, if you wanted to make biscuits similar to what we do now, light and fluffy, you would have to be a baker proficient in chemical reactions and multiple leavenings. Yes, yes. Bisquick, the idea of having... but that idea of... Just think of... People didn't have bread ready to purchase off the shelf. If you're going to feed a bunch of people, you just might want to make some bread. And biscuits are a good way to do it. So in... This is actually rather recent. In 1931, a new time-saving baking mix came to the market as an inexpensive solution to the slavery of housework. Bad use of term there. Slavery of housework. What the manufacturer of Bisquick neglected to mention was that the catalyst behind the product was an African-American chef who in 1919 composed a baking mix to help him crank out the hot biscuits fast. And that kind of took off like house of fire. And unfortunately, the chef's name has so far been lost to history. Lots of people making good things in the kitchen.
Well, so last night we made something. We're going to talk about Anson Mills, which is in South Carolina. And it is... Basically, what this fellow has done is try to recreate and have grown out the original grains of the 13 colonies, mostly the South, and a lot of and the milling techniques, because those are important to find the right varieties and then to mill them the way they were done traditionally. If you're trying to look for authentic historical flavors. And I must say, my experience with Anson Mills is that the quality of the product delivers on flavor. Even if you don't care about the history, the flavor speaks for itself. It's really quite exciting. So last night we had something called 13 Colonies Waffle Mix, which is basically they have some original wheats that he's grown out, and it's mixed with rice. So I made it up because waffles... are used in the same way as biscuits, as a quick bread for dinners, you know, when you couldn't just go to the store and buy it, you had to make it all. And they can be savory or sweet. We had ours sweet last night, but savory waffles are wonderful, like waffles and fried chicken, or waffles and gravy, or any of those things. So waffles and biscuits are kind of a lost art, and we do well. And biscuits are really related to scones too. It's the same technique, slightly sweetened, so you know it's a treat.
Yes,
a treat that it's not too hard to accomplish, I must say. It's, you know, we could be doing more of this.
Mm-hmm. The idea of biscuits for tea time turn into scones. Yes, they do. And that is also something that if you happen to be an indentured servant, a slave in a Northern European household or Northern European moved to the United States household, tea time and biscuits were a big thing. So, but one nice thing about the cooks in the kitchen at that time, they brought their traditions and flavors with them. One of the things that shows up occasionally for biscuits and scones was the idea of adding citrus to things, which is very much a African or Mediterranean thing. And that was some, those kind of flavors, the idea of vegetables, fruits, meats, moving around the world, those kind of flavors were brought to the baking and the kitchens of that time.
Well, I first started working with some Anson Mills products actually a long time ago, maybe 20 years, 25 years, because he had some corn polentas that I found really, really interesting for making grits and polenta. And my first... the first thing I ever used of his was a red corn, red-ish corn. It's deep yellow when you eat it, but let's see what it's called if I can pull that up. Anyway, it was a corn that was grown in America. Like all corns, it was eventually sent to Europeans and, like, you know, the Italians. They have perfected polenta, which are polenta is basically the same as corn grits. Depends on how finely you grind it. You can have a rough, big polenta just like a grits, or you can fine grind it and it's a little bit smoother. But there was it's red in the field, and it was no longer grown in this country. So they actually, to get that authentic American red corn that was grown in colonial times, they actually had to go to Italy and bring some of the seeds back and start to grow it out here. And about 2006, I was down in Georgia working on some video footage about natural foods and organic foods. And we were out with a young Georgia farmer who was doing organic production, and the sun was at it was late afternoon, and I see off in the distance this red glowing ruby colored, and it's tall, and I go, oh, corn, you know, and we go running over there, and it was just this beautiful, beautiful color of red, and he tells me that he's growing it out for Anson Mills. And so of course we it was drying on the, you know, on the cob in the fields, because this was in the fall. And so we picked some, and I took it back to the kitchen I was working in, and I actually put it in a coffee mill and ground it up and cooked it, just because I wanted to see what the flavor was. And it was so delicious. So you can still buy that from Anson Mills. I'm trying to think which one. Fine yellow. Oh, it's the Artisan Handmade Coarse Rustic Polenta Integral, I think is the one
that's a pretty long name.
Yes, it is.
So
why we're talking about Anson Mills is it is a website that you can go to and order. They do, you know, wholesale selling to chefs and food service in very large quantities, but they also do sell for home chefs, and there's a retail market. And I, once in a while, I order from them. Now, what you have to know, and he's very Glenn Roberts. He's very adamant about this, and I happen to agree with him. What we forget in our large mass produced flour milling and rice trading and all, you know, the kind of stuff that you buy at the grocery store, is that these grains are alive, and particularly the wheats, and all of them have a germ in them, and all of them have an oil in them, and the oils and the germs in these grains and corns has a shelf life, and it's short, and it can be rancid really quickly. But so much of the milling has pulled, you know, all the bran out, all the oils out, that really what you're getting is, I used to call it wallpaper paste, right? Yeah. But when you buy from Anson Mills, you are encouraged to store it in the freezer and eat it quickly. Yeah. I mean, one of the beauties of it is that you place an order, and it is freshly milled just before they send it to you.
Yum.
So, and they're, of course, really strict on their inventory control, so that the grains are not, you're not ending up buying a rice that's been sitting in some warehouse for a couple of years or something. It's freshly harvested. So when you purchase from them, to appreciate this quality, either you got to eat it right away, or you got to store it in the freezer and then eat it fairly quickly, because it is a fresh product. And what he has done is all over the Southeast has contracted with local, and it's all organically produced, farmers to grow out some of the heirloom grains that, you know, we were losing. And so he's done a really fine job with corns and rice. Now, there's been a lot in the High on the Hog book and a discussion about rice, because the lowlands of South Carolina are a large rice producing. Now, rice is not, except for, you know, Native American wild rice, which is not technically a rice. It's a grain, but the Americas did not have rice. So rice was one of the things that was brought to this continent. And the area of South Carolina called the Low Country is a pretty big rice producing part, and became a really big deal during the slaving times, because they actually specifically imported slaves. Dr. Harris was saying this last night, that the slaves that were brought from the rice-producing countries in Africa had a higher value because they knew how to farm rice.
Yes, we're going to find out more about rice because there is a wonderful, big, long story we need to tell. And I'm going to just step in here and say, this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOI. The Donna Lana Kitchen is tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Kitchen. We're talking about black cooks and black food and American food that is, we owe a lot to the black cooks in this country. We were inspired by a book called High on the Hog, and we heard a lecture last night from Jessica Harris. She talked a little bit about rice. I remember her saying, now there are potato people, and there are rice people. And you kind of have your favorites.
So we're talking about Anson Mills, which is a company which you can buy from through mail order to get some of these original grains that were grown. And so if you want to taste the food the way it was grown in, 1700s or something, you can... of course, try to recreate the recipes, but even if you have the cookbook, if you don't have the same ingredients, you'll get something quite tasty, I'm sure. But for fun, it is often interesting to explore these unusual old heritage varieties. So Anson Mills, which is founded by Glenn Roberts, then kind of early 2000s or a little bit before that. He started growing out the original Carolina Gold, is what it's called, rice, which was, and I had to ask Dr. Harris last night because they brought in particularly slaves. So the two varieties of rice on the planet that were original either are the Asian ones or the African ones. And of course they were bringing in the rice growing, African slaves for their skill in agronomy, basically. And what happened, because the South Carolina are the lowlands, they were able to create the canals and the gates and the things that fed the rice fields and things like that. I think it was in High on the Hog, someplace they mentioned that more earth was moved in creating this rice-growing region in South Carolina. More earth was physically, humanly moved than was moved to create the pyramids.
Oh, my.
So that was a lot of back-breaking work, basically. And rice became a very, very large colonial export of certain quality of rice. So I asked Dr. Harris last night which the Carolina Gold rice was, and she said it was actually based on the Asian variety of rice. She said they tried bringing the African variety in, but it wasn't... it just wasn't viable enough on this continent. So basically, still the Carolina Gold rice, though it was basically raised by the know-how of Africans, it was based on the Asian varieties. And then they say on the Anson Mills thing, they talk about, of course, that the black slaves did a lot of the agronomy. Also, we have to mention, because is that some of that the labor also was still a lot of Native Americans, because they were still in the Carolinas there, you know, and all over the South, there were still a lot of Native American that were, well, we don't call them enslaved, but they were certainly forced to do a lot of labor, just like the slaves were. So anyway, Anson Mills has done a really good job of presenting some of these, growing out the corn varieties, the rice varieties, and the wheat varieties that were used in the colonial times. So the products that you can buy, which I have used, there are a lot of several kinds of corn grits and blue corns, pencil cob grits, the Henry Moore yellow hominy corn, the Appalachian heirloom sweet flint popping corn. So they have corn meals, and then they get into the polentas. Now, the milling of it is a whole nother thing. They do the special kinds of grinding. It's stone ground, and it's done at a certain temperature, because in the grinding process, if you get too much heat going on, it kind of affects the flavor quality of the oils in the grains, both the wheat and the corn, and even the rices, because they do make rice flour and things like that. So they have recreated the techniques for grinding at low temperature and do a lot of fresh milling. Then the flours, I have loved working with their flours. They do, they have colonial style artisan whole wheat flour, rustic coarse gram wheat flour, and here's another one, colonial style fine bolted pastry flour. Now that is really beautiful. It's like working with feathers. It's so light and so delicious. They also make a fine cloth bolted white llamas cake flour. And then, as I said, the 13 colony rice waffle flour, which we tried last night. Then they grow out some other traditional grains from, they actually do have an Italian rye flour, and they do grow some Japanese buckwheat, and then they have farro. And then we get to the southern peas and beans. So there in the Carolinas, there are the sea islands, the islands that are all kind of off the coast, which had its own unique culture. It's where a lot of the slaves first landed on this continent, but also a lot of the Native Americans lived there, and there was and it was kind of a rough place to live, because of course it was swampy, bugs, malaria, mosquitoes, it was a wild place. So more of the white people kind of retreated inland, which left the Sea Islands to kind of have their own, it's the Gullah culture, and you can read about it, and there've actually been some beautiful movies made about it. So along the Sea Islands, they grew these little red peas, and you can buy them, and they're delicious. They're a fairly small bean. They also grew a lot of what they call bene seeds, which are sesame.
B-E-N-N-E,
bene seeds.
Bene seeds. I've run across that.
Yeah, now
it's, I know.
It's sesame. And, of course, they use the oils from that. And, so all of these things, you can actually order them up and give them a try. And I've enjoyed them a great deal and continue to.
Yes, wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. You mentioned the importance of milling and keeping the temperatures just right. I guess maybe since this show, I've spent a lot of doing the show with you, Donna. I have been spending more time in the kitchen over the past few years. And I never thought that flour had a taste. But if you have something fresh, I have been enjoying exploring new kinds of flour. Because, yes, they all act differently. And, yes, they all have interesting good taste.
Well,
very good.
And we do have our favorite farmer friend, the Hafner family, Earl and and Jeff, who actually have gotten into the milling business in Iowa. And you can get fresh milled Iowa-grown corn and wheat from them. Londa's been, we've been trying a new, they're now going to bring out an oat flour pretty soon, and we'll do a show about that probably in the fall when they're ready to release it, because we've been trialing their product. They have this mix that has, let's see, what is it?
Oats, rye,
corn, and wheat.
Right.
All freshly ground and then mixed together for a baking mix.
I've tried that, and it's wonderful. Good stuff.
Yeah, it has that a lot of character in it, because it has that grit of the corn in it. So, like, Lana made thumbprint cookies a few weeks ago with it, and it was so good. I went home and baked a batch of it myself, too. So when it is available on the market here in Iowa, we'll be telling you about it.
Yeah, it just seems like the kind of thing you want to test in things and try them. And I like making quick breads and biscuits and muffins, too. So.
Do you keep your flour in the cold store? I try to keep mine in the freezer.
I mostly keep it either in the in the refrigerator or the freezer, or what I'm going to use kind of, you know, soon. I have it out on the counter.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I have quite a collection now.
Well, and I tend to use, like, the Hafner's Mill, they have a pastry flour. So we have to remind you that there's hard wheat, which is really good for making breads and things like that. And then soft wheat, which is a lower gluten content, is really good. It's pastry flour, basically. So I keep two kinds of flour at least.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of the go-to, we need a something flour for something.
And
keep it handy.
And what you have for, it's labeled pastry flour, and there is whole wheat pastry flour and pastry flour. The whole wheat obviously still has more of the bran in it. I have to say that whole wheat pastry flour is probably my kind of go-to. I'm not a huge bread baker, so I keep a lot of whole wheat pastry flour. And I do use whole wheat pastry flour in any, like, even a cake recipe. I find it gives a little more flavor. No matter what flavor of cake you're making, even if it's chocolate or a yellow cake or anything like that, it feels more substantial. And it's going to be a little heavier, probably, mm-hmm. but not noticeably. It's just mm-hmm. got that homemade character to it.
A little oomph to it. Mike, our engineer, had a question about bread. Buying bread in the grocery store, and about sprouted bread. Tell us what you've had a question about.
Well,
Mike.
Just basically, when you toast that sprouted bread, are you killing some of the benefit of that?
Well, my understanding that sprouting grains, and they do this for almonds also. You'll find sprouted almonds.
Really?
It's the grain, which is really a fruit, like a nut is, you know, in that sense,
sure.
has been allowed to enzymatically sprout itself and move more towards, you know, like when you're storing and harvesting a grain, you don't really want it sprouting because once it starts sprouting, it's like when you have your onion and it's sitting there for a long, it starts to get the little green sprout coming out of it, and you go, oh, I got to use this quickly. Well, it means it's ready to go into its growing stage. So a sprouted grain is something that has been allowed to germinate, basically, or begin the germination, which does change the enzymatic quality of and the nature of the grain itself. So when you're making a sprouted grain bread, basically you let the grain sprout and then you grind it and then you bake it. So it is still subjected to a baking process.
Sure.
So it doesn't change the quality if you're going to put that bread in the toaster, for example.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, when things sprout, it's the magic of life. It's like the seeds are reaching for nirvana. You know, they're just going on to the next stage, turning into the next generation. All this stuff is dynamic, like you mentioned. Things are alive, and we are cooking with living things.
That's one reason why the milling process is so important. Mm-hmm. The higher you take the temperature in the grinding stone, it's cooking the flour before you're ready to cook it, basically. And it does change the nature of the oils in the grains, mm-hmm. and the flavor of it. So keeping those millstones below a certain temperature, and then, of course, either using it, we forget that for hundreds of thousands of years in the grain-eating history of humans, basically they would pound it and then eat it right away. It wasn't like they were... If a grain had to be stored, it was stored whole. So, because it degrades. As soon as you start crushing the grain, it degrades more quickly. So the manufacturing of the flour, whether it was, the homemakers just pounding the grain themselves or crushing them through with small stones or anything that breaks down the grain, you are going to eat that quickly.
Yes.
So we don't do that anymore. And anything that you can do to preserve the integrity of the original grain, which is basically refrigeration, will help maintain the flavor and probably the nutrient quality. I mean, why not?
Yeah, let's make this stuff not only tasty, but let's make this stuff good for us,
too. And I usually find the tastier something is,
the better for.
The better for it. Of course, that doesn't apply to like potato chips and things like that, but.
With a caveat. Okay,
yeah.
Fine. I want to remind you this is KHOI and listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about cooking, and I have a little thing to share here about frying, deep fat frying. That is, I learned last night, that is pretty much an African. Gift to the world is deep fat frying, just because of the way you cook over an open fire a lot. And if you're going to cook something, we're not talking sauteing here.
Yeah, we're going way back before the invention of the deep fryer.
Right. This is like put a pot on and put stuff in.
Put a few rocks around, make a little place to build the fire, then you set the pot on the rocks. This is, pretty rudimentary cooking, but to be able to have oil to do that.
Right, and the gifts of different cultures around the world giving us all of these things called fritters. I'm going to read a little paragraph here from the Jubilee Cookbook, and actually this is one of the places where she cites Jessica B. Harris. Fritters. Fried dough? Yes, that's what we have here. Frying in deep oil is one of Western Africa's gifts, Jessica B. Harris tells us. It's a technique that has produced great pleasures all over the continent and all over the African diaspora. We're frying pounded cassavas, yams, or plantains mixed with water for West African fufu and kuku, little donuts known as sweet balls in Ghana, Nigerian bean balls, akara, Senegalese pastels, masa, and brown rice fritters of the Mali, Creole rice fritters, the Calas, C-A-L-A-S, that Black Street vendors once sold on the street corners of New Orleans to buy back their own freedom. Long pones sweetened with sugar and served with jerk pork that the Jamaicans call festival hush puppies. Also remembered by some old cooks as the hominy puffs and corn fritters from the Old South and Caribbean fruit fritters with chopped mango or mashed bananas. This all sounds pretty darn good. Recipes for fried dough abound in black cookbooks. Oh, yum.
Well, and you have to remember the oils that you're frying, because that kind of we're not talking about a sauté.
No.
To do a deep frying, you need enough oil that the whatever the food ingredient is can kind of be immersed in it. So, obviously, in colonial America, lard would have been a wonderful use for that. But also in West Africa, they have used, I think for a long time, palm oil. But the palm oil there is red and has a very, very distinct flavor. It's not like the palm oil that we're getting from Indonesia, for example. That was another source of oils for frying.
Yeah. Another thing was some peanuts. Well, it was fun. At the lecture last night, Jessica Harris asked about recipes, and we talked about things. And one of the questions or one of the comments from one of the people at the end of the program was this young Iowa woman said, "I've never heard of okra before. I have no idea. What does one do with okra?" And, of course, that is a whole other story all to itself.
Oh, Lana is a big okra grower. We've been championing okra for a long time. She did say, okay, Jessica Harris did say one thing. If you don't like okra because of its...
Mucilaginous.
Yes, the mucilaginous, the slimy characteristics of okra. She said if you... do not cut, the more you cut the okra, the more it produces that slime, right? So if you think you don't like that part, you can just fry it whole or grill it whole, yeah. And you will get a lot less of that quality. So
good.
If you're launching off into okra for the first time, try eating it whole. Now, and she did say, and Lana knows this is true, if the okra is too big, don't buy it. You want the little ones. The little tender ones are the good ones. The big ones, well, it's like the big zucchini. Somebody let it go too long on the vine, right?
Words of wisdom about okra. Another little bit about what was mentioned last night about black cooks and the black gifts to our culinary traditions. The groundnut or the peanut. Now, the groundnut and the peanut come from Africa. Groundnut is actually a separate thing, but peanuts are called groundnuts. Peanuts are not really nuts at all.
No, they're legumes.
Yeah, known as the American groundnut, earth nuts, grubagubs, peanuts, pindles, and pindars. These are edible seeds. They are actually legumes, and they are the foundation of a variety of soups, stews, and breads and sauces in Africa. Well, I like that peanut taste in things. Reclaiming that expertise for his community, Dr. George Washington Carver...
of ISU fame, right?
Yeah, he was here. He offered 5 versions of peanut soup in his bulletin number 31, How to Grow the Peanut, and 150 Ways of Preparing It for Human Consumption. Ground peanut soup. His recipe, a modern version of it, calls for 4 tablespoons butter, 1/2 cup minced onions, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 1 tablespoon all-purpose flour, 1 cup natural peanut butter. You don't have to grow the peanuts and roast and chop them all up. You can just use peanut butter. And add 1/4 chicken stock, heavy whipping cream, salt and pepper, and hot peppers to taste. That sounds pretty good. I mean,
I have to say something. If you're using peanut butter out of the jar, read the ingredients, because if you're buying, like, Skippy brand, it's not just peanuts in there. There's palm oil, there's sugar, there's a few other things that might not work so well in the soup. If you're going to cook with the peanut butter, you need to buy, the natural peanut butters, the kind where the oil sits on the top and you have to stir it in yourself and there's no emulsifiers in it. That you can cook with. It's mostly just straight ground peanuts. But do read the ingredients if you're trying to cook straight with the peanut butter. Although... the Skippy's version makes a wonderful peanut sauce. There, the classic, junk peanut sauce for, like, Asian foods is condensed milk and peanut butter, right, mixed together.
It'll get us through dinner. Yeah, that's good. We've been talking about African American foods and black cooks and all the good stuff that are
and the contribution to what we consider American food by the black communities that were involuntarily brought here is way bigger than you think. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, we
enjoyed it. It's a history worth studying.
We enjoyed it. And after Donna gets done reading the book called High on the Hog, I intend to dive into it myself. Yes. So, I want to end this Donna Lana Kitchen talking about not food in particular, but talking about winter, and heaven knows we've had some recently.
Oh, hopefully we are approaching the equinox. It's coming.
Thank you. thank you. Good. It has been a long winter, and boy, the weather has been kind of blowing things and snowing and freezing things across the country. It has been a long one. Well, this is sort of a tradition. I've played this tune before on this show. Sometimes you just kind of have to say, jeepers, enough is enough. And this is a tune called The February March.
The February March.
Today was awful cold, to say the least, and then the sun slipped out of sight. There ain't a fit night out for man or beast. We're gonna make our move tonight. We'll pick the mothballs off our uniform. We'll get the white shirts filled with starch. We'll get the polish for the flugelhorn and do the February March. We'll do an old man winterectomy. We'll march him right on out of town. We're gonna hang Jack Frost in effigy for bringing Mother Nature down. And in the air that goes like Novocaine, we're gonna crack. We'll throw the fishbowl through the thermopane and have the outside in for lunch.
And when we look out at the window tomorrow, it better be brighter than ever before. There better be birdies and bees and the leaves and the trees, and there better be ugly green. Wanna see all of the icicles after the bicycles all on the way to the shore. Wanna see lovers removing their parkers and proving the love of, you know what I mean. I tell you we're all getting weary, a little Siberia, cheap is enough is enough. I tell you I'm okay when it's 80 and May, but oh, when it's zero and dark. Better be manifestations of summer vacations and moving the arm of my dog. Wanna see rivers and roses in the bottom.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks for joining us today. I want to remind you, we've got a podcast.
Yes, you can listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen in podcast form anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donna Lana, that's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, yes. Kitchen, and find us in the podcast.
There we are. We're good. So hang in there. Spring is coming. Yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at www.khoyfm.org. This is a fine community radio station. Support your community radio station. It brings you fine stuff like us. A lot of good stuff on this station. We come to you, the Donna Lana Kitchen, that is, comes to you live at noon, Tuesday. And we were repeated Tuesday in the evening at 7 p.m. Yes, we do this show live. You'd never be able to tell it would have been. Okay. We do this, and we have a good time doing it, too. So support this fine radio station. We had music by the Barn Owl Band, where the musical priest was playing earlier. And we had the music by Lou and Peter Berryman, The February March.
Birdies and bees and the leaves and the trees, and they better be ugly green. Wanna see all of the icicles after the bicycles all on the way to the shore. Wanna see lovers removing their parkers and proving the love of, you know what I mean. I tell you.